This is London calling North America. The British Broadcasting Corporation presents London Letter, in which John Connell, novelist and editorial writer of one of London's daily newspapers, gives his comments on interesting happenings of the week.
This is John Connell from London. The dominant conditioning factor in everyone's life here for days past has been fog. Our comings and goings have been subject to the fog's caprices. Our silver has tarnished, and our drapes and our chair covers have taken on a thin, moist film of grime. And the liner Queen Elizabeth was held up for so long in Southampton docks, she became a gag for radio comics. Fog, of course, is one of London's oldest, most famous natural phenomena. The whole world knows about it. It's the fixed belief of most Italians, for example, that on at least 363 days in every year, this city is enveloped in a deep black, impenetrable fog. And I have heard that in some of the newer nations of the British Commonwealth, children grow up holding firmly to the same article of faith. I've got a cousin in South Africa, a man of about my own age, who paid his first and only visit to this country as a medical student 20 years ago. He was a hearty, vigorous young man, and he hated the British climate with an alarming, full-blooded hate. True, he was a student at London University, and he was not very well off, and lodged, therefore, in one of the more dismal parts of London. And he spent his vacations on the farm of some aunts of his and mine in the Severn Valley in Gloucestershire. And there, day after day, all through the winter, the soft, wet mists used to seep up from the river marshes, so that the whole house seemed to be in a gentle, constant steam. The walls oozed, the furniture was clammy, and one's clothes always had a certain persistent sogginess about them. No wonder poor Cousin Alec, coming from the high, dry, central plateau of the Transvaal, detested it. But London's climate, I assure you, is not really as bad as all that. It's perfectly true. We did have fog here for a week, and it was a mess and a nuisance. But it's one of the inevitable conditions, not a very harsh condition, of living where we do, on this wide, shallow plain through which the Thames winds to the sea. I imagine that when the first of our ancestors, centuries ago, made their way down from the hills through bog and woodland, and made a ford across the tidal waters, surely one of the first facts that they became aware of was this drift of river mist across the valley. It was in medieval times that smoke first began to mingle with the mist to make London fog. London was a walled city then, of all timbered houses. It was the big steeple of Old St. Paul's standing out above it all. Its citizens were rich, trusting, acquisitive. And sometime in the Middle Ages, they took to burning what was called sea coal in their hearths to keep their damp, rambling houses warm. This coal burned with a strong, black, wasteful smoke. Edinburgh, the capital of Scotland, where the people developed the same messy habit, was not so damp a city, but it too was intensely smoky, so much so that its citizens had an affectionate name for it, which was Auld Reekie, Old Smoky. London had its fog. The bigger London grew, the more dense and frequent became its fogs. But it was the 19th century, the Victorian age, which was the era unparalleled of fog. London was spreading and sprawling rapidly. It was the biggest, richest city history had ever known. It was also one of the murkiest. To it came the railways, more and more and more of them. Ancient London, the city, was ringed with small factories and workshops beyond number, all using coal in their processes, and with immense residential suburbs, mile upon mile of streets, in every house of which, in almost every room, an open coal fire burned all day long from October to April. Oh, the rattle of coal scuttles! Oh, the polishing of grates and firearms! Oh, the sweeping of chimneys! The chimney sweep was one of the great characters of London life in Victorian times. And until far on in the century, the sweep, large, burly, soot-blackened, jovial, and a bit frightening, it was invariably accompanied by one of the most forlorn, one of the most pitiful of all the figures in the vast Victorian gallery of human strangeness, tragedy, humour, and pathos. This was the little boy Sweep. Tiny, frail, filthy, this poor little imp was sent up the crooked crannies and twists the narrow, steep ascent of countless chimneys which no brush then devised could penetrate. In prosperous middle-class nurseries, it was widely rumoured that this was an employment forced upon little boys who were very, very naughty and did not hold onto Nanny's hand when out walking, who strayed and ran away. It was held that their cruel masters savagely whipped these poor little creatures and starved them to keep them small. It was reported that when a novice of 6 or 7 years old was reluctant to go up some black, menacing crevasse, a fire was lit in the hearth beneath to make him nip up the quicker. Of course, it was a dreadful example of the exploitation of the helpless and the poor. Sentimental clergymen and sentimental maiden ladies went off in transports of pity for the poor, suffering little sweep. And certain conservative politicians brought in legislation to make such employment illegal. But down the years, long after the last little boy had been shoved up the last chimney, the legend lingered of old cruelty, lingered on into my 20th century boyhood. And in your country, in families of English origin with English associations, families in which Charles Kingsley's Water Babies was a nursery classic, the old story was still told and became part of the great, strange, muddled myth, true in general, yet often in detail, wildly inaccurate, which Victorian England projected of itself. Another part of this myth was the fog. Well, Victorian London was foggy London. There was a special famous or infamous brand called the London Particular, or a pea super. Thick, black, all enveloping, moist, smelly, and heavy with congealed soot. It was a powerful and pervasive influence in our ancestors' lives. It blackened their buildings, so that, for example, Christopher Wren's vast, noble Renaissance pile of St. Paul's, which ought to have stood out white and gleaming above the mass of other buildings and against a clear sky of Mediterranean blue. Well, instead of that, which was how Wren dreamed it, St. Paul's took on a different, stranger majesty. It loomed dark, immense and indistinct through the swirls of smoke and fog. And in this hazy grandeur, it became the very symbol of Victorian London in the minds and memories of all who knew and loved it. A genuine pea super, a real London Particular, was a very formidable experience. I say was, you may notice, because there hasn't been one for 10 years or more, and knowledgeable folk doubt if there ever will be again, in the sense and with the savage, relentless fullness that our ancestors knew. You see, more and more of London's local suburban railway system has been electrified. The underground, the equivalent of the subway, is internally electric. And more of the power used in London's industries is electric. Offices and shops are in the vast majority heated by some kind of smokeless fuel. And even in homes, electric and gas heating has increased and increased. Although, of course, the Englishman's love of an open fire is still proverbial. So the smoke has dwindled. And that was the factor which turned mist into fog. I do remember, however, one or two pea supers in my boyhood. And even on into my young manhood in the 30s, as I observed, a formidable experience. At midday, the sky would be as black as at midnight, all lights on in offices and shops, buses and cars, the moisture smearing over everything with a soft, sooty trail, the unhappy stumble if you stepped out of a ring of guiding light, the manner in which people and traffic loomed up out of the murk. But most persistent and most pervasive of all the fog's qualities, the smell and taste of it. It had a way of coating the inside of your mouth with a greasy film, so that you felt as if you'd just woken up after a long sleep in a coal mine. It had a way of gripping your throat and making you choke and sputter, and it seemed to seep into your vitals, so that everything you ate and drank tasted of fog. It was quite unforgettable and almost indescribable. Yet, wreathed in this foul, moist vapour, Victorian London was ripped, powerful, famous, praised and respected by foreigners and loved by her children. In this generation, we've defeated the fog to some extent, though not completely, of course. But the myth about it lingers on. It's part of the general myth about the English climate. About the English climate, which it's customary to detest, I don't profess to hold ordinary or fashionable views. I love the English climate, as I love so many other aspects of England and English life, which other people despise and dislike. I have no objective view of it. I've lived and worked in other climates, and my travels have led me to the firm, unchallengeable conclusion that I like English weather best of all. English weather is as variable as Atlantic weather. In the small compass of the British Isles, there is, within temperate limits, an astonishing variety and changeability of climate. Its moistness and its mildness are its most persistent qualities and its best. As the old-fashioned guidebooks used to put it, extremes of climate in Britain are mercifully rare. We don't have hurricanes, we don't have dust storms. If we don't have a shower for 6 weeks, we regard it as a major drought. On the other hand, we don't have monsoon torrents of rain. Blizzards are infrequent. We have a heat wave which hits the headlines when the thermometer goes above 85 degrees. But we do have gentle, changing skies, the white clouds trailing soft, sunlit fleeces towards misty, blue-gray horizons, streams that bubble and sing effortlessly all the year through, woods dark with leaf in summer, bare and wind-tossed in spring, and a little field, green, oh so green, with thick, soft, springing grass. If you've lived too long among the bare, brown hills of the East, as I have, and longed for one blade of green, fresh grass, you've learned how immense are the simple things for which one is grateful. When I was in Delhi 5 years ago, I bought one particularly ferocious day in the hot weather, a little book of verse by an English woman, Peter Sackville West. And there were some lines I used to say again and again to myself, all through those terrible, merciless weeks of blazing sun and heat. They're from a long poem called The Land, and I'll read them now, to show you why a man like myself prefers the darkest, wettest fog in England to any other kind. Such arid months as only exiles know, with longing for the smell of English rains, some drops to lay the dust, some shower to stir the earthy redolence of soaking loam, some saddening of the sky before the shower, some dew to hold a footprint for an hour. When through the stones the lizard and the snake rustle their brittle length, and crickets chirp day after day, and broom pods cracking break. This know, and know then how the heart can ache with pining for the woods and clouds of home. If I could take my England, and could wring one living moment from her simple year, one moment only, whether of place or time, one winter coppice feathery with rhyme, one shred of dawn in spring, then should my voice find echo in English ear. Then might I say, that which I love, I am. And this is John Connell, signing off in London.
John Connell was speaking in the series London Letter. This is the British Broadcasting Corporation.